Schweizer Amerika. News from the Sister Republic. A University of St. Gallen podcast by Claudia Brühwiler. Grüezi miteinander and welcome to a very special episode of Grüezi Amerika. It's a special episode for three reasons. A, we're recording live at Square with a lovely crowd. B, personality in residence Professor Jacob Soll is our guest today. All our guests are special, of course, but having a personality in residence with us is extra special, as you have also flown all the way from California to us.
Thank you.
And C, I have a co-host, Wolfram Eilenberger. He's a philosopher, best-selling author, magazine founder, and TV moderator. Most of you probably know Wolfram as one of the hosts of Sternstunde Philosophie on Swiss Public Television. If you don't, it's high time to tune in. I think it's Saturdays, right?
Sundays.
Sundays.
Oh, like see, the church.
I'm always watching it on the Mediathek, so... So that makes me a bad reference point. So tune in. This year, he has joined the HSG family as a fellow at the newly established St. Gallen Collegium. And he is the host of a new podcast that is part of the HSG podcast family. What's up with that, Wolfram?
Yes, we thought that we have a podcast for the newly founded St. Gallen Collegium. That is a new invention by the HSG. I think it's the first collegium of an economical school in the world. And we address, as eight scholars coming from all over the world, one pertinent question to current discourse, philosophy, academia, and politics. And our topic this year is reinterpreting freedom. And the podcast is called Ohne Senf, No Mustard. For the people from St. Gallen, it is clear why. We will explain it to Jacob later. But the first thing that we would not like to do is our Senf dazugeben, to talk Senf, to talk idly. We would like to talk content and new ideas and grand perspectives on reinterpreting freedom. And there's no other guest that I would rather talk to on this topic than our personality in residence, Jacob Soll, who is, I should say, a strange and dangerous man. I don't know if he's more on the strange or on the dangerous side. But strange he is because he is probably the only philosopher in the world holding a chair for accounting and philosophy. Now, I'm a philosopher myself, and I don't know if they have anything in common. No one ever told me that. But in my mind, accounting and philosophy are the farthest away as I could imagine. For you, not, apparently.
No,
Jacob.
Not at all. That's not the way it was. Accounting is the first printed book on accounting was actually a philosophical treatise on celestial mathematics. That's by Pacioli. He did not invent accounting, but it was seen within a philosophical mathematical context. In the 18th century, great philosophers learned accounting. It's has theories of loss and balance. It clearly comes from an algebraic logic. It's deeply embedded in the world of creation in the Renaissance, but also as pertains to my new book now, it is related to computing. Computare in Latin means to account, and it will have a very, very strong role in the rise of the mathematics that will lead to machine learning. And that's my new book right now.
There you have it. The birth of philosophy from the spirit of accounting. Mm-hmm. That is one new idea that I have to digest right now. But he's also a dangerous man because in his books, in his writings, in his teaching, he is into myth busting. And the greatest myth that is controlling or influencing our society right now is probably the myth of the free market and the free market ideology. And that is also the title of Jacob's latest book. It's called Free Market, the History of an Idea, or rather, Jacob, the History of a Phantasma.
Yeah, it was supposed to be called The History of a Dream, and it was changed. And that led to a lot of confusion in the United States because the wrong people bought the book and were very, very upset, and they have a lot of money and backing, and they came after me for a long time. So a lot of drama involved with that, to be honest.
May I guess that the Cato Institute didn't invite you for a talk?
No, not at all. The Koch, every single person that attacked me whether they were academics or not, and I can, I can't name names, but you can Google them. They, one way or another, they were related to the Koch brothers. Koch brothers' money was flowing into them. The Koch brothers have sued Donald Trump over the tariffs, but their publications say nothing about the tariffs. It's not clear they really believe in free markets to me, obviously, or democracy, which is why they behave like they do. But I didn't think that this book would matter to them. I think had it been presented in a different way, it might not have. But the reason I believe it does is that because it talks about ancient history, Rome, it talks about the Catholic Church, it talks about Christianity, and those are things that, at least in America, they like to have control over that discourse. And the left is kind of wishy-washy and talks only about modern history.
But there are three takeaways from this book that are quite devastating to contemporary free market ideology. The first would be, you correct me, Adam Smith is not the founder of free market ideology. The second, there has never been a free market. And the third, if there was a free market, it wouldn't work.
Well, right. So of course there are free markets. There's just always a condition. And that's one of the theses of the book, is that almost every free, until the 20th century, free market thinkers always said, if we're going to have a free market, we're going to need an enlightened absolute monarch. We're going to need subsidies for food. We're going to need the state to invest. There was always a state role in free market discourse. That's until the 20th century, when we get Hayek coming in with what I call his kind of understandably paranoid vision of the free market. Of course, we've never seen a totally free market. I joke, but not completely, at the end of the book, that South Sudan is the perfect free market. There's no government. And actually, you had some American conservatives celebrating Sudan as a perfect example of a free market because they took no foreign aid and they had no foreign influence. No one was helping them so that they could develop a perfect free market. And we've seen just how remarkably successful that's been. But I do believe that markets can be more free and less free, right? And so right now the joke is that I don't really like Donald Trump's version of not having economic freedom. You know that in America, we can't receive packages now. I mean, you can't receive a package. That's literally insane, but that's part of the plan to kind of close everything down. So I really miss parts of our free market, because they're related to freedom too, obviously. So there are real parts of free markets that are real. And then there are others that are dreams. One thing that I really wanted to say is the reason I called it a dream is because free markets are always spoken of something that will happen in the future. So again, I believe this is a monotheistic, very Christian discourse of salvation, which will come, or the second coming. And we're constantly waiting for it. We just have to be good. We have to do the right things. We have to stop paying taxes altogether. And then Jesus will come.
Is that the reason, this religious quality you see in free market dreaming, that has led to this idea having a particular hold on American politics throughout the 20th century?
Absolutely. The American style of religion, which is also coming out of a certain brand of Calvinism, right, initially, became very materialistic. There are non-materialistic versions of Calvinism as well. But there's a very hopeful, progressive, secular Calvinism that will turn into dissenting churches, such as Unitarian churches, whereas this idea that we will build the city on the hill, we will build a perfect system on earth, a system that reflects nature. So it actually goes beyond Christianity and into the old nature cults of antiquity. And that's where I bring Cicero into the story. The reason I bring him into the story is that until John Stuart Mill is the last kind of market thinker who talks about Cicero. Before that, almost every person who's talking about markets or free markets talks about Cicero, usually because his moral structure, coming from nature and an agrarian culture, is seen as absolutely necessary for these perfect conditions of wealth creation.
But how come then that a so deeply religiously infused culture is able to separate virtue from free market thinking?
Well, because we start seeing, actually, I have a student working on this right now. We start seeing the transformation of prudence, the ultimate virtue of earthly action, which came from antiquity. It comes from Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. It's deeply embedded in Ciceronian thought, Prudentia. It's the basis of Machiavellian republicanism. In the 18th century, the late 17th century, we see it changing. I actually did my PhD on the transformation of prudence in late 17th century Europe. Mm-hmm. But we see it in the early 18th century turning into frugality. Mm. Here I am in Switzerland, a country based on the very idea, quite literally. What my student has discovered, we think, is that some of the most transformative texts are coming from Daniel Defoe, who really is a brilliant, brilliant thinker, who's thinking across literary lines, economic lines, philosophical lines. And we're trying to actually pinpoint this moment when this great human idea of prudential virtue that's based on history and experience becomes frugality, which is very materialistic. And obviously this kind of base capitalistic value. And we think that changed at the beginning of the 18th century, actually. And Smith, by the way, has a actually quite sophisticated definition of prudence and of frugality. That's one of the most interesting parts of The Wealth of Nations. He takes it to quite an interesting place.
Now, you have sketched out how the idea or the dream of the free market has really still a hold on certain parts of American conservative culture and establishment. You've mentioned the Koch brothers. But at the same time, the grand old party, the Republicans, have seen to be falling out of love with the idea. When just a couple of years ago, they were fearing that someone like Rand Paul would constitute the economic future of their party, they are now really thinking big government. So how come? How is it really a reawakening, a waking up rudely from a dream, or is it just a different type of nightmare?
That's a great question. The first thing is we're at a point now where Rand Paul is one of the few people talking about the Constitution and free speech. I never thought that I'd be thankful for Rand Paul, and I am. Please continue, Rand Paul, to defend
Yay, Kentucky.
Yeah, well. This goes back to Karl Polanyi's idea that if you actually really have a market that becomes totally free, or in the sense you get rid of all state apparatuses and involvement in the economy, it's much easier to turn into an authoritarian state. He warned about this a long time ago. The Republican Party, and this I say in my book, we had already seen when I started writing this years and years ago, that the Republican Party only liked free markets when it benefited them. And I'll get back to that. But it had kind of reduced free market thought to tax cuts. Mm. And that's where we are now, where Trump says we want a free market nation. They're still saying that, by the way. Mm. I couldn't believe they used that. By the way, Ted Cruz has actually publicly disagreed and is going to run for president on a, quote, real free market platform, which, believe me, I actually prefer to what we have now, although they're obviously quite related and they have worked together. But yes, there are a couple things. Obviously, as a nation, you call for free markets when it's beneficial for you. So we see Xi Jinping constantly saying we want free rules-based trade. Now, obviously, the Chinese don't follow rules, but they like free trade because they are the manufacturing, dominant manufacturer, and now possibly technology center of the world. So if we have free trade, they will most likely win and take over every market. Have you ever been in a Chinese automobile? I mean, once you're in it, I never thought I'd see it. I didn't. You're just like, okay, no one can compete with this, along with many other technologies like their phones. I mean, it's literally astounding. As soon as Americans began to realize that they were not number one and that they were being beaten by people that don't take vacations or watch football and are also missing certain other, let's say, physical qualities that many Americans have, they wanted to change the rules.
But Jacob, they could have realized that 40 years ago.
Right, but the American people have been, normal American people have been crushed. I don't think Europeans realize you go across America and it, I always make a joke when foreigners are here. And I said, well, this is when the Germans bombed this area. And people actually believe me for a split second. I say, right, right. Obviously, the Germans did not bomb this area, but it sure looks like they did. Okay. Actually, had the Germans rebombed it, we might have rebuilt it. You know, no, Americans are living in a terrible state. People are dying deaths of despair. They're ODing. They're in terrible physical condition. They're living in constant fear. They're surrounded by guns. It's that part of America is actually tragic, right? Free markets didn't work out for them. Those places were the centers of American manufacturing, where you got a high school degree, you could get a Chevy, a motorcycle, your kid could go to college, and you could have a great time. And I partially grew up in the Midwest a little bit, and you could see that a lot of that victory was simply based on World War II. We had won the war, Europe was crushed, Asia didn't exist, America was doing great, but it didn't have to fight that hard to win. And suddenly competition came along. And by the way, China wasn't playing by the rules. And last night we had a discussion that Europe also hasn't always been playing by the rules with trade balances and fairness and these things. And that has led to an enormous amount of bitterness in the United States. Mm. It's a bitter, angry, scary place. And when you get to Europe, no matter how bitter and angry Europe is, it's a lot more peaceful and calm and happy. That's something when you get off the plane, you feel immediately. It's striking.
So have they been waiting for a new William McKinley as a certain president purports to being?
Americans don't know who William McKinley is. They don't really know. They actually are against tariffs, if you ask them. So they believe in free market thought. They've been pumped. This idea has sort of been pumped into American life. But they don't know what's going on. If you talk to them, it really has to do with an idea of strength.
Mm.
Who's strong? This is a big issue in America. What the cost of food and living and gasoline are the costs. And the more theoretical aspects are totally lost. So it's quite easy to inject racism and xenophobia into. I mean, it's not surprising when you see the promises that were made. Remember, people's living standards have not changed. They have not gone up. Salaries remain where they were in the 1990s.
But do you see any historic parallels to the current economic regime or whatever we want to call it that the Trump administration is following? It's obviously not truly McKinley, but what is it?
I don't. I don't see him as a real mercantilist. I don't believe he has an ideology. I believe he works like a mobster, essentially. So the parallels are Russia, Turkey, Hungary, although now Hungary actually looks kind of nice compared to America. And believe me, I spent 22 summers of my life in communist Hungary. Hungary is still warmer and more friendly. I don't think he has a model. I think he's using whatever comes to mind. But I do think the real estate market in New York in the 1980s is his model, which is partially mafia run. Mm-hmm. And then Putin and other dictators are the sources of envy. So you mix New York real estate mafia with authoritarianism, that's where you should be looking. Mm-hmm.
Jacob, it's funny that there is a conceptual emptiness. It's hard to address what's happening right now. It's hard to find the right concept. Adorno once coined the term of a racket system, a mobster-like system, mm-hmm. where the most powerful industrians just work in their own pocket.
Yeah.
In Germany and in Switzerland and Europe as general, right now, the consensus seems to be that this is a new form of fascism. And there's this fascism is on the rise. I'm very unhappy with this. And the battle cry of fascism was, in the beginning, everything for the state. Now, that is not what Trump's doing, is it?
No, everything for the Don, quite literally, in both senses of the word, right? You're going to be shocked, and I'm not sure if I should say this in a semi-Germanic setting. Thank God they are not real Nazis, because the real Nazis were coming out of the German legal system, coming out of the Prussian military. They were highly educated, highly skilled, and coming out of the German army, which was actually far more trained in many ways than the American. They were a lot scarier. The thing is, they didn't have nukes. we brought them over to make them later and some other people too.
So you think it's just a lack of competence that's different?
No. No, it's a different ideology. It's got fascist tendencies. So it's Trumpian mob government with fascist tendencies.
But you also have the post-liberal faction that is truly present there with thinkers like Orrin Cass from the American Compass organization that do believe that their suggestions will improve American economic progress.
Yeah. You also have Christian Dominionism. So that's for a long time. We've also had a movement of authoritarianism within fundamentalist Christianity, which has been there for a really long time. And people have not looked at the history of certain churches dating back to the 17th century, that this is deeply embedded in America, as is protectionism. And I've written about that for the New York Times. America was a protectionist country. It was not a free market country until well into the 20th century. It was always a protectionist country. But as far as this new regime, there's also the fact that we were a racist, heavily violent racist state. And this is part of American life. We had thought that we had gotten further than that, but that is also a deep authoritarian tendency. Now that's mixed with liberalism, with all these fabulous open cultures that America has produced. It is a very strange balance, but clearly now it has heavily tipped towards this dark original sin of slavery and the American Confederacy, which is, I mean, the connection is not a false one. And that this is the return of the Confederacy. This is the return of an anti-scientific religion, which is connected to the Confederacy. By the way, the Confederacy believed in free markets, yeah. Calhoun, because they benefited cotton. And it was actually the northern states that needed protectionism because they were building industry with which they crushed the South.
So it's part of the southernization of American politics in a way?
Well, that's one aspect. We didn't realize how strong it was. But remember, it's Mitch McConnell who really did all this. And now he says he's mad at Trump. I mean, he created a Supreme Court that clearly seems to believe in a form of, what do they call, unified executive. That's a great, you know, it's an Orwellian term for authoritarianism of one way or another.
You also advise European governments, governments in Southeast Asia, if I'm correctly informed. Now, all states in Europe, and particularly this one, are grappling with the realities of a tariff regime as they have never seen before from the United States. How would you advise them?
I mean, we talked about this earlier in my visit, that there should have been a coordinated response to just resist. And it's simply Trump would have been deflated. But that didn't happen. There was chaos. There were people bowing at his feet. And now that I think back, it would have been quite hard. For example, the Japanese really never believed, because they're such good allies. And the South Koreans, and of course the Taiwanese, these countries never believed that America would do this to them, because they're so key to American security and economic power. But he did. So there was not a coordinated response. There now needs to be a multilateral response against this. If not, there will be constant chaos. And what we're already seeing is we're seeing tariffs being thrown up here in Europe. People are going to get a lot poorer, because this is not a good thing that's happening. So I mean, one of the problems is everybody's split up right now. This is one of the least multilateral moments, even without Trump. And that poses a problem. But of course, he sees that, right? I mean, everyone says he's an idiot. Okay, he might be illiterate. He might be dangerous in his thinking, but he's very good at being bad. So he always senses the weak spots that people have, like a really good mobster, right? Mm-hmm. So, I fear that Europe has responded poorly and does not yet have a great strategy. And I know that many European leaders are thinking that they're just going to have to go their own way. I mean, this is hurting Europe. showing its weakness.
But Trump also distrusts experts of a certain kind, maybe experts like you.
Sure.
People who said 4 months ago, and this is puzzling to the average newspaper reader, if you do that with the tariffs, there will be chaos, will be mayhem, the economy will collapse. I look at the newspaper, stocks are up, America is doing completely fine as far as we go. There is no chaos. And then you could think maybe the theory is wrong. Maybe his instinct is better than the theory.
Okay, so his instincts, I mean, he goes on instinct. He doesn't really know what's going on. A lot of this has been suggested to him. I was one of those people, I'm going to admit, that said by Christmas, there won't be toys on the shelves.
Right. Things like that. Apocalyptic visions
But there's been a lot of wealth lost. The market, don't listen to the market. The market's insane, right? I mean, look at activity in ports. Look at the price of gold. Look at other things. Inflation and the cost of living for normal Americans is just going up and up and up and up and up and up. And I mean, you can see it. Although Switzerland still does seem expensive. Groceries here are crazily expensive. I thought groceries were expensive in Los Angeles. But the thing is, we're seeing it go up all the time. It's getting really crazy. I do think it's going to be a cold Christmas for most Americans. It's going to be tough. And they're really feeling that. We're losing jobs. It's not just AI. I know that because who are the biggest economic drivers, percentage-wise in the United States, who creates the most jobs overall? It's often the American universities. We are firing people at a staggering rate. So the richest places in America are usually centered around universities. The biggest employers in Los Angeles, I don't even want to say this, but I guess the Trump administration knows because some of my students work for it, are UCLA and USC, two universities in LA. We're the biggest private and public employers. We are shedding people. We have to. We're firing people left and right. It's terrible. And so these job losses are starting to pick up and they will have vast ramifications. So my sense is that talking to industrialists, talking to economic leaders, they've eaten a lot of the costs, which means that people have lost a lot of money. Market value is doing its crazy thing. There's euphoria, there's madness. We'll see what happens. I do know that jobs are being lost. Businesses are going out of business, small businesses in America. But that we knew from the start was part of actually the plan of many people in the Trump administration.
But you see, I think there's a battle of trust going on within the general public. And it's the battle of trust, experts versus Trump. And the experts come up with this apocalyptic vision of what's going to happen if he has his way. And right now, my fear and feeling is that Trump is winning that battle of trust.
I don't think he is actually with the American people. I think that the American people were swayed by recent assassinations and then Trump, the assassination attempt on Trump. So he looks strong, but their daily lives are not getting better. So if you look at those statistics and if you talk to people, it's still based on we're going to wait and see. Now things aren't going well, but we're going to give them another 7 or 8 months. I don't know what else they really have to believe in, but the things that they see in front of them, jobs, cost of living, world news, none of it's making them happy. I mean, Americans are extremely pessimistic and unhappy and scared right now. So I do think for Trump, Trump is in a race against time to consolidate power. And that's why you have people like Ted Cruz already getting ready to run for president, because the American people still like free markets, and he's going to try and I think that will be his response. It might actually work, which would be really interesting in some ways. But I'm not sure we're going to have elections either. I think that would be naive to think we're going to have fair elections in the United States. But this thing about the experts is true. And the bubble of the Ivy League has been dangerous for a long, long time. The disconnection from the world and from average people. But also the fear now COVID did a lot. Even though America, my father helped develop vaccines, the vaccine was a miracle. It was incredible. It saved millions and millions and millions of lives. But the information war with COVID was lost. And so people now, many believe that in fact the vaccine was bad. So we're living in a world of conspiracies and misinformation. Last night we looked at an article that showed people are just, in certain areas, 50% of people are homeschooling, which means no schooling really. So it's just because they don't trust the schools. They think they're going to be indoctrinated. Yeah, it's a massive crisis of trust. But Americans don't all trust Trump. He's pretty low. And with the Epstein thing, it's not helping him.
I mean, part of a self-correction of the system could occur with the next midterm elections. And the question is, though, what alternative do the Democrats have on offer in terms of economic policy? Because you've only mentioned Ted Cruz, who's challenging right. the current economic regime and who is essentially going back to old school Republicanism. But would the Democrats have a better plan that people would trust?
Oh, boy. First of all, you're assuming there are going to be free and fair elections. I just don't think that's going to happen. But I'm an expert, so I could be wrong. Mm-hmm. But I'm using my gut with that one. I have no evidence. I'm just using instinct. If I'd committed as many crimes and corruptions as certain people in the U.S. government, I would definitely not let the election happen. It's too dangerous, right? So that's one logic. The Democrats do not have a plan. What's interesting about Gavin Newsom, who stands out, the governor of California, is he has not enunciated a clear economic plan. And you just made me realize that's not good because that's what Americans want. They literally just want to know, will beef prices go down? Can they get their burgers? That literally is like a coffee. Coffee's a huge one. Coffee, burgers, and eggs. That's it. And beer.
It's the eggs, stupid, really?
Yeah, no, the eggs are a big deal because do you know that 22% of Americans, most Americans just eat beef, huge amounts of it. Per capita, more than 100, is it 100 kilos or 100 pounds? Europe is below or around it. Japan, the country we should all emulate, 33. That's what you should go for. In fact, St. Gallen should discover fish. That's something I'm recommending to St. Gallen.
No, there's a lot of overfishing. I don't think we should go in that direction.
Well, I think that St. Gallen people should eat fish. There are fish farms, and I recommend fish protein. But
Greenpeace doesn't, but well.
Okay, then soy. But soy also, Americans have a lot of cheap soy to sell right now. I can make you a great deal on a trillion tons of soy. Anyway,
I'm not sure I want the biodiversity consequences of that, but okay.
Right. Or we can.
sell your plans to me, but maybe you can sell an economic plan to the Democrats.
Well, so the thing is that he hasn't come up with a simple way of saying here is what's going to make life easier and better. And that's where free market comes back again. And that's where I think Ted Cruz is no fool. Everyone's always hated him. He was hated at Princeton. Mm. People hate him. He never seems to lose, actually. He's another kind of cockroach of the American system. But he did stick up for free speech. We'll see if that holds. I liked that. This guy has pulled out free markets again as his economic plan. And that is a simple idea that Americans have been fed for years, so they kind of know what it is. I think it's really interesting. Really, really interesting, and brings back this the importance of this dream again, that he can suddenly, if there's anything they can sell America right now, it's a dream. By the way, America's rich enough. It's not France and England. We actually could improve people's living standards quite easily. We're not in an economic death spiral.
But Ted Cruz wants to sell the free market in New York City. The Democratic Party wants to sell something quite different. So
the Democratic Party in New York wants to sell something like the Swiss have. I mean, it's not that extreme. You know, rent control, some better transportation funding, better health care. I mean, what people call extreme socialism in America, I mean, it looks like a train station in Switzerland. So, I mean, you just have to be aware of that, okay?
You spoke of experts, and that brings me to your mission as an academic mission, because you're kind of an anti-expert, actually. You claim that the experts that we have in economy are unenlightened, uneducated, walking around in the darkness of their own ideologies without having checked where they come from and if they hold.
Yeah,
so you should be a hated man around economic circles because you tell them you know, you haven't done your homework, not even a bit. And when you do it, you will lose faith in what you pray.
I am not. So in East Asia, I'm a big best-selling author. In America, I'm not big enough to be hated. There are a couple big pieces. One big person dislikes me. Another one hates me and has made sure that I've suffered for it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm just not big enough to be fully hated, but they're also so powerful still, these economists, especially within media controlled situations, that they've been on, that I'd hoped to crack through with this. I didn't know what I was doing. These are monopolies. They make a lot of money from this. I mean, if you take someone like Niall Ferguson, he makes huge fortune as a so-called economic historian. There are other famous people too. We talk about how much they make. They're very careful about who can get into this market, but it's a small market. Interestingly, because Asia doesn't believe in economic ideology, that's where I've been really big. And I think that's kind of funny. I will tell you this, I've done bizarrely well in Northern Europe and in Switzerland. Mm. And I think that's interesting where I always try and understand why I have readers in certain places. Actually, Britain too, I've done pretty well. A certain amount of literacy, a certain amount of pragmatism, I find it interesting.
But you also teach at universities, and one quote here, you're not coy about this, is to the students, take this, St. Gallen, the entire economic story you have been told is backwards, the entire story. Yeah. So things that are taught here are positively wrong and backwards.
Yeah, we talked about this in my class with the students. I mean, they have been examining Adam Smith carefully to see actually what he says. And I think I could get a nod from them. He doesn't say what you've been told. Is that not right? I mean, they read the book themselves. They've looked at it. And I've been teaching this course at the University of Southern California. My students decide. And actually, out of about 18 to 22 students, I always get one or two that still come up with the standard reading. But listen, in the most sold textbook in economics in the United States by Greg Mankiw, he says that Adam Smith would have loved Uber. It's literally ridiculous. Adam Smith didn't like businessmen and he hated companies. He distrusted them. He says that greed is what makes the markets work. And that's Adam Smith's idea. Well, Adam Smith wrote an entire book about why greed is bad. And it doesn't take a lot of brain power to read The Wealth of Nations to see that he's actually not celebrating greed. He's trying to find a way to deal with something, which is actually quite dangerous. But that does have possibilities. That these economists have not even done the basic reading on Smith is absolutely astounding. And the fact is that greed exists, but their idea that they constantly say unfettered markets are the things that create wealth. Well, that's not necessarily true. California is still like the sort of richest place in the world with 37 million people. It has the highest GDP per capita of any large scale place. It has high taxes. It has a high minimum wage. We plug our money into public higher education. All these things that aren't supposed to work, and yet we're super rich. Why? Well, maybe the story is totally different. Maybe wealth creation isn't about free markets. Maybe it's about education. Maybe it's about industrial policy. Maybe it's about culture. And so, the fact is Asians are no longer reading those books. The Chinese didn't get rich on those books. They read them, decided what was good and bad, and created their own economic theories.
But Jacob, there's a bigger question behind this. Economical theories are possibly the most powerful theories we know in terms of impact in the world. Now, philosophers are obsessed with their own history of ideas, if they're non-analytic. They do their homework. They get back to the sources.
Right.
How can it be that the most impactful, powerful science on Earth is uneducated about its own history?
I mean, look, people were saying this from the creation of economics. I mean, Edmund Burke warned about this. He warned about the sophisters and the economists and the calculators. And he warned about their ignorance of history. And by the way, I'm writing about Burke right now in this new book that I'm writing. This really is actually Burke's, one of his great insights, is the ignorance of history. Now you start getting these figures like Piketty, who write, they now say they're historians. Now, being a historian is not actually that easy to do it well. It takes a lot of training. There are some good places where you can learn to do history, but there aren't that many where we're doing history at a really high level. The training's intense, the work is intense. Piketty comes in with his Capital, which is a book that, while I kind of agree with the finding, I laugh at it as an actual work. There's a student that I know who was on his research team who resigned over his use of data. And I can just tell you that what's the problem of looking at GDP all the way back into the 16th and 17th centuries? Can anybody guess? GDP is a modern creation. Mm. It's just literally.
Concept didn't exist.
It just didn't exist. Mm. And the concepts that did exist of how to measure wealth and what statistics existed are very hard to match with that. So you'd have to do a lot more work. You'd also have to come up with different concepts of wealth. And so we see Holland and England having these remarkably high living standards, actually, at certain points. He sort of ignored that. We actually see moments of incredible mobility in Holland and England between the 16th and the 18th centuries. It's pretty interesting. As a historian, it was kind of a joke. So I will actually say this, and my colleagues in the economics department at USC, which we have a good economics department, they started saying, we want to do history. And they started showing me their historical work. And I said, this wouldn't pass an undergraduate seminar, let alone a graduate seminar. So be extremely careful. I think it's interesting that you think, as an economist, you can do anything. And it shows me the lack of standards in economics.
So there's a hubris in the abysmal science?
Absolutely. Oh, no, absolutely. They scoff at accountants. By the way, if you ask some of the most successful industrialists in Switzerland, and believe me, you have them, if they listen to economists or accountants.
So they distrust the very experts that you embody.
They don't hire them. I mean, you have companies. Listen, I know some great economists, and the economists that I'm friends with trust accounting. But I mean, the number of economists who have laughed at my last book on accounting, well, most of them were Western. In Asia, no, that did not happen.
But Jacob, economical theory is in a crisis. The universities are in crisis. This is a university that is focused on economics. And the humanities at that very university are under pressure, as in many other universities. So it seems to me almost impossible to believe that there's no consciousness for the importance of the very studies of the history of economy regarding the state of present-day universities and the present state of economic theory. It's absurd.
It's a big problem. This university has an interesting, well, many universities do, but this place in particular, because its specialty is management, and management is often another word for accounting. So accounting is taken seriously here. The problem is the decline of the interest in the humanities. It's not always by the students. It's often by administrators in America. We're fighting about this. Actually, USC has done pretty well, but most majors at USC are business majors, and they have their own teachers of writing and history. That's a big mistake. So yes, it is a big problem. Now, companies, believe it or not, are pretty smart. And one of the things we've been seeing is they're not hiring the computer scientists and even always the kids from the business school. They're actually hiring our philosophy majors, who are better trained, far more skilled at critical thought. They're doing really well, our philosophy undergrads and those whom I've trained in intellectual history as well.
Not so much the analytical department, because they're too much specialized on their own.
They're specialized, but if they are specialized in something mathematical, they end up working for hedge funds.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, we send a lot of students into the world of finance. The ones that can't get the jobs in philosophy go on to get rich. We're a top department in the world, and our students are really talented, skilled, and weird. And that's a good thing. However, the humanities are having multiple crises, some of their own making too. There's one thing I do want to say though, is that over and over again, students do want to take humanities classes. And I will say this, one of the ways our philosophy department has dealt with this is by taking on a program of philosophy, politics, and economics. Mm. It says economics, therefore students paying. We are the most expensive university in the world, I think, the University of Southern California. Parents want to get something out of it. I understand that. But many of the students want to read books and learn. By having a major that says philosophy and economics, and philosophy, politics, and economics means they can get an economics degree while reading books. And so some of the smartest students rush into the program and they're so relieved to be there reading hundreds of pages a week of history and politics and philosophy. It's fantastic.
I think that's a great pitch for a new program that we should launch here in St. Gallen. Now, but to conclude, for those students who are now enrolled in an economics program and who want to be better economists, but do not have the time to read hundreds of books through a year, what do you recommend them to do? How do you become a better economist?
Well, I was about to say read Dickens, but that takes some time. I mean, I honestly think that the 19th century novel, you're going to think I'm crazy, is probably the greatest coding invention that we've had until now, that it can do more for the human brain, and at the time did more for society than anything I've ever seen. And one of the issues, even with my top students, is that the muscle of the brain hasn't been trained, because it's like a sports thing, to read more complex novels. Mm. Although there's a new sort of fad in reading Russian literature. Yeah. I'm like, if you're gonna read Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, be my guest. And those students, they are supercharged. Are they going into the humanities? No, a lot of them are going into AI, and they're moving past their peers. The great novels of the 19th century will supercharge your brain. I'm seeing it happen. Listen, I have students who, before working for companies like McKinsey, that I've openly complain about and opposed to McKinsey in particular as a really rotten company. And I know I'm not supposed to say that here, but I will say it. I had a student heading not to McKinsey, but to another place. She asked to do an individual research course on 18th century moral and economic philosophy on her own before heading off and doing that. And I was like, okay, you really want to read 1,000-page works of philosophy before you go off to make all your money? And she was like, yes. And she did that. And I said, she will be formidable. Mm. And she, formidable.
Jacob, you were a student once too. What was the book that freed your mind? What was that book that really made you tick?
Well, you can't say Tintin anymore. but all right, I'll admit it. The Count of Monte Cristo when I was 10 years old.
And what was it that attracted you to this?
I loved it.
That's enough for a book.
And once, once I did that, in the French way, Alexandre Dumas, the Three Musketeers, is actually a 26-book series. I read all of that. And then that's an entryway drug for Balzac. Mm. And then you read all of the French novels. And then you head into Britain, and then you head into Russia and Germany.
And then you become a philosophy professor.
I'm a historian, but a historian of ideas.
Yes.
And by the way, the reason I became a historian of ideas was because of literature. I saw literature as the greatest form of historical writing.
Interesting. Which is your favorite Dickens? Hard Times, The Pickwick Papers?
Oh, Dickens. That's a really, really a hard one. Oh, well, you know, the one that I like a lot, but it's also because it's a book that's in a very sophisticated way about accounting. It's a hard book, is Little Dorrit. Actually designs the book as a ledger balance sheet, and the function and flow of the rhythm of the writing, he's such a genius, actually mirrors the way you would keep an account book. If you know how to actually keep accounting, you realize he's keeping accounting in the book, and you say, it actually gives me chills to tell you this. You say, my God, he's operating on such a high level. Dickens is a genius who was able to change the entire world through literature. Hmm.
We have almost come full circle in praise of accounting for philosophy, for the novel, for the understanding of our history as a civilization. Now, the very last question of this new podcast, No Zenf, No Mustard, will be, if you were to be offered a sausage here in St. Gallen, and St. Gallen is huge on sausages, would you eat it? With or without mustard?
With.
What do we do now, Claudia?
We need to close this podcast.
So you don't eat the sausage with mustard here?
No, that's a sacrilege.
Okay, so just understand that I grew up in France. Mm. There is nothing.
It's not an excuse here.
No, not really.
I will say this. You make some very fine mustard around here. And so it was out of respect for the mustard and not the sausage that I answered the question.
We have to leave it at that.
But by the way, does that mean that you're going to take me out for sausage?
Absolutely. We will do that.
Well, I'm going to have a heart attack, actually. I will say this is a very meat-based cuisine. It's going to be all Portuguese fish and sushi for the next 6 months, but I'm ready.
And so are we. Thank you so much, Jacob, for joining us.
Dankeschön.
Thank you, Wolfram,
for doing
this co-production. And thank you all for listening. We're looking forward to your next episode of
Ohne Senf.
And Grüezi Amerika. And with that, auf Wiedersehen. Thank you so much.
Tschüss.
Thank you. Grüezi Amerika. News from the Sister Republic. A University of St. Gallen podcast by Claudia Brühwiler.